shall we? Acorns are dropping off my Chinese house. Two ducks in my spotless, fiery as a mouse. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing.
Welcome to Yarns at Yinhu, a podcast about the fiber arts and other post-apocalyptic skills. Lucky Lentils and Vogue Knitting Live, Tuesday, 21st January, 2014. I'm your host, Sarah, podcasting from Yinhu Chaoyuan, Silver Lake Tea House. You can find show notes and links to everything I talk about, plus photographs on my blog at yarnsatyinhu.com. You can find me on Ravelry and Twitter as Sarah Pomegranate. This week's episode features the following segments: a little bit of learning, ever-expanding skill set, yarn lover at large, the back porch, and the front porch. This week I heard from the following listeners: Boxton, who is Deb from New York, Amy J., Amy from Ohio, Miss Lily Knits, Rachel from Kansas, Jenny H. Ice 56, Jenny from North Carolina, and there was a new 5-star rating on iTunes. We are still going strong with the Bulk Bins Cook Along. The spotlight in January is lentils, and I will be sharing a recipe I made in the past week in the next segment. But before that, I want to talk a little bit about something I neglected to mention in the last episode. Laura Brownlee had made a comment on the show blog that lentils are traditionally eaten on New Year's Day or in the new year as a sign of good luck. And I didn't mention that lentils are part of such a tradition in the previous episode. So I wanted to talk a little bit about that and also a few other foods that are considered lucky. Some of these I had heard of before and some of these were new to me. So first, a little bit about lentils. Like black-eyed peas, they are another lucky legume. Because they resemble tiny coins, they are often thought to symbolize wealth and financial rewards, especially when eaten around the new year. In Italy, for example, it's customary to eat sausages with lentils after midnight. In Brazil, lentils and rice is typically the first meal of the new year. Some other foods that are considered auspicious in the new year, and I think we can safely say eating them in January constitutes eating them for the new year, are long noodles, and the length of the noodle is meant to represent longevity. Also, in China, whole fish is considered lucky because it's a symbol of abundance. Cornbread is considered lucky in the South because it's the color of gold. And in many places, round fruit symbolizes good luck because round red fruit is meant to suggest the human heart. This information came from the Whole Foods Market website, Lucky Foods for the New Year, and I will link to that in the show notes. Ever-expanding skill set. This past week, I tried a modification of a recipe that appeared in the Bulk Bins Cook Along thread on Ravelry, which, by the way, has been going very strong, and a lot of folks are in there sharing recipes and ideas, which is just fantastic. I did post my version of barbecued lentils in the Ravelry thread, but I will also be posting it on my website as well. So anyone who is not a Ravelry member can go in there and check it out. Karen was the person who initially posted this barbecue lentils recipe. It sounded very good, but but it was made in a crock pot, and I don't have an appliance like that. I actually have very few appliances in the kitchen at Yinhu because it's incredibly small. It's very poorly designed, and we haven't gotten to redo the kitchen yet. So I just kind of work within the confines of the design. And one of the methods I use to cope with the poor kitchen design is as few appliances as possible. So every time I find a crockpot recipe or someone raves about a slow cooker recipe, I think about how to convert that to something that I can cook in my Le Creuset cookware. In this case, I made a few adjustments, and I also employed the two techniques I talked about in the previous episode, which are one, salt slows the cooking process of, I guess it's all legumes. I knew it was true for beans, but then I read it's true for lentils as well. Salt stops or slows or retards the cooking process. So it's best to add salt to a dish with lentils only once the lentils are at or very near the level of doneness you would like in the dish. The second thing that I tried with this dish is that in order to make lentils more easy to digest, it's suggested that you add them to already boiling cooking liquid as opposed to adding them to liquid and then bringing the whole pot up to a boil. So I worked on using both of these techniques in the dish. I thought the lentils were incredibly easy to digest, and we did not suffer any of the common side effects of lentil eating, shall we say. So here's what I did to make these delicious barbecued lentils. In a heavy bottomed pot over medium high heat, I sauteed onions for about 3 minutes. I added chopped carrot, celery, and garlic and continued to saute for about another 3 minutes. No salt, even though I typically use salt when I saute down those ingredients. I did not add it. Once everything was reasonably softened, I reduced the heat to low, covered, and allowed that mixture to sweat for about 7 minutes. Then I poured in the stock. I was using some stock from leftover from my Thanksgiving turkey, which was wonderfully rich and very smoky. So I let that stock come to a full boil and added the lentils. I stirred, then reduced the heat to low and covered, simmering for 12 to 15 minutes until nearly all of the liquid had been absorbed by the lentils and they were getting rather soft. I cooked the lentils sort of like how I would cook rice, actually. Then I stirred in the remaining ingredients, which included a half cup of organic ketchup, salt, a quarter cup of brown sugar, 3 tablespoons maple syrup, 3 tablespoons balsamic vinegar, and a cup, it could have been more, it could have been nearly 2 cups of leftover diced turkey breast and thigh that I had frozen, also from our Thanksgiving turkey. I stirred in the remaining ingredients and let that cook and bubble for just a moment before putting it into a 350-degree oven and letting it bake the way I would let baked beans bake in the oven until the top had a little bit of a sugary crust on it and it was all bubbly. I served these barbecued lentils over baked potato. I'm not sure why that idea came to me, but it's just what was on hand. You know I cook from what's on hand. And it seemed as though they needed to be served over something. The dish was not as thick as a chili or baked beans. It was a little bit thinner than that. And I suppose you could drain all of the liquid off and reduce that and add it back in and make something a little more syrupy and unctuous. But I didn't. I just ladled it over some really nice baked potatoes with a little pat of butter underneath and served it like that. It was really good, and it was nice to have comfort food with the flavors of summery barbecue mixed together, because it has been unreasonably, unseasonably cold here in eastern Pennsylvania and very, very snowy. It just seems we have one snowstorm after another. In a typical year in this part of the country, I would say there are 2 to 4 snowstorms with appreciable snowfall. And it seems like it's only the 21st of January. We could still get a lot more snow. I've already done more than my fair share of shoveling. So we're experiencing a bit of the winter doldrums here in mid-January already. And it was nice to have some summer flavors to relieve that malaise, at least for an evening. And then all of the subsequent lunches I took to school with me last week. You are invited to share recipes, photographs, and links to things online on the Bulk Bins Cal thread on Ravelry until the end of the month. You can also post these things to Twitter with hashtag BulkBinsCAL, trying to get everyone involved in our cook-along. And around this time each month, I will let you know what next month's ingredient in the spotlight will be. Next month, February, we will feature oats in the spotlight of our Bulk Bins cook-along. That's for those of you who like to plan ahead. Yarn lover at large. On Saturday, I took a trip into Midtown Manhattan to visit the Vogue Knitting Live event. I did not plan well in advance to attend this event. It just kind of worked out that I had time and that I was meeting my friend Renee in the city as an after Christmas get together. So I took the train and walked to the Marriott Marquis. When visiting New York City, Midtown is not my favorite place to go. So I had a little bit of mixed feelings about heading over there, but it did start snowing on my walk uptown from the train station, and that was nice. I think seeing some snow in New York is always an ambient plus. Vogue Knitting Live is a lot different from the one other fiber event that I've attended, which is Rhinebeck. It's much more of a conference, and the confines of a hotel make the whole thing a lot more closed in. And it also makes a lot of things harder to see, because the indoor lighting in hotels makes everything meld together after a while. So I was glad I had limited time to spend, and I was glad that I chose to spend it the way I did. My number one priority was to attend a lecture by Clara Parks. If you've been listening to the podcast for a while, you may recall that I did a little bit of a review and read a brief excerpt from Clara Parks' memoir, The Yarn Whisperer. It was while I was doing a little bit of background research on her that I discovered her year-long Great White Bale project. I did not know about it, even though the project just ended. It's been going on for a year. The very brief overview is that Clara Parks was induced to purchase a 676 bale of wool. It was uncleaned, and it was from a farm not too far from Midtown Manhattan, actually. That would end up being way more yarn than one person would ever need in a year, probably in a lifetime. So she created a project where she would divide up this wool and seek out American mills and dyers to participate in creating yarn from this wool. And she would have subscribers to this program who would not only be recipients of the yarn, but would also travel along with her in a virtual fashion as she made decisions about how to turn this wool into yarn and have it dyed in some cases. The lecture I attended about the Great White Bale was a 1-hour overview of Clara's year and what she learned in the process. She had a number of photographs, also some videos that she filmed at mills where she was having the yarn processed. One of the most exciting parts of this venture is her initiative to find American businesses to do all of this work. And it's no secret that the textile industry in the United States is waning. I mean, that's to put it mildly. But there are some last vestiges of the industry. There is some new and innovative thinking. And certainly some of these places were able to turn out just beautiful product that's really wonderful to work with. And she had sort of a squish and see table at the end where you could look at some of the yarn that was made over the course of the year. It was a very gratifying lecture. She's an incredibly intelligent and articulate speaker. There were two main takeaways from this hour that I will share with you. One is that Clara Parks said she went into this whole endeavor interested in the how, interested in how yarn is made. As a yarn reviewer, she has often found herself at the other end critiquing the process. And she thought that she would learn a great deal in negotiating that process herself. And she did. But what was more compelling than the how was the who and the why. The people behind the textile industry in the United States, the people raising the sheep, trying to rejuvenate old mills and repair old equipment, folks interested in various kinds of techniques in dyeing, conserving energy, conserving water, thinking about what's good for the environment, and why they continued in that process when doing those things overseas is so much easier and so much less expensive. So she started interested in the how. She ended up more compelled by the who and the why. I thought that was some nice closure to the story. The other thing she said is that with every skein you buy, every skein of yarn you buy, in fact, with every purchase that you make in any industry, you are making decisions about what kinds of practices and what kinds of people you support with your dollars. So we should think carefully. And I thought this was a compelling message as well. So you're probably wondering if I made any purchases while I was at Vogue Knitting Live after hearing those directions from Clara Parks, and I did make a purchase. I'm going to talk about that in a later episode, however, because I haven't started to knit with that purchase yet, and I'll have a lot more to say about it once I do. Instead, I'll say a little bit more about visiting Vogue Knitting Live and some other things that I did while I was there. The marketplace was split into two floors, and there were vendors there, but there were also a number of artists and other events. One thing that was going on was a fashion show from the Fiber Factor series put on by Scassell. It was narrated by the young woman who was, I guess, in charge of putting that project together for the company. On the runway appeared a great number of the fashions that had been featured in Fiber Factor, and there were others that were displayed on mannequins in a other section on the side of the stage. This went on for quite some time, and it was really fascinating because the narration was very precise and details about the work that had gone into the garments was carefully explained, and you were able to really take a look at all the different fashions and the viewpoint of some of the designers. So that was going on in one floor of the marketplace, and then outside in the atrium area on each floor before you entered the vendor area were a number of exhibits by artists working with fiber. This, I thought, was one of the highlights of Vogue Knitting Live, that there was such attention given to fiber artists. The artists were there and they were more than willing, most of them, from what I observed, to talk with anyone who had questions about the work. And there was one artist in particular that I talked with for a very long time. Her name is Ashley V. Blaylock. And she was sitting inside an installation of red crocheted lace. This crocheted lace was done on a very large scale, and it was strung up inside a frame, and then it was lit up with all kinds of lighting. And one of the things that I don't think was intentional, but had nevertheless happened, was that because of the lighting and the way it was directed, there were magnificent shadows made by this crochet lace all over the ceiling around the exhibit. And Ashley was sitting there, she was crocheting on yet more red crocheted lace, and really the abundance of the red color was just in your face, impossible to miss. The title of this installation is Keeping Up Appearances, and in talking with Ashley V. Blaylock, I came to think a little more about contemporary attitudes toward the domestic arts. That's what she was interested in creating the installation. Since doilies were initially something that a housewife would put around the house in an effort to show visitors and others how pristine, how careful her housekeeping, how lovely the interior, and how careful everything was arranged, Ashley Blaylock has chosen to question some of those assumptions and cause the viewer perhaps a bit of discomfort by working in an incredibly large scale in an almost violent color red that's suggestive of blood. It's also suggestive of a kind of intimacy. It makes you think perhaps of bloodlines and other kinds of relationships. We had a really nice conversation, and I will link to this installation and the artist in the show notes on the blog for you to check out, because I think there are some provocative ideas there, something that really got me thinking and kept me thinking long after visiting the event. The back porch. This week, I completed a project I've had on my wheel since the episode I recorded about figs. It is 4 ounces of Falkland in the sour fig colorway, dyed by Patricia of BZB Fibers, one of my favorite places to buy fiber. I decided to spin this fiber fractally, which means that I divided it in such a way that when I spun it onto 2 bobbins and then plied it together, I would have a lot of barber poling, or 2 different colors wrapping around one another in the ply. I did get quite a bit of barber poling. I also got quite a bit of yardage. And while a lot of spinners lament that they don't get as much yardage as they would like to out of their spinning, I think I have the opposite challenge. which is that I really need to work on spinning things a little less fine so that I could get a DK, a worsted, or maybe even an Aran weight yarn from the fiber that I'm spinning. I blame my Protestant upbringing. And I feel like when I'm spinning, I keep thinking like, oh my gosh, you know, I need to make this last as long as I can. I need to make as much yarn from this 4 ounces of fiber as I possibly can. And then I end up spinning it pretty thin. The yarn is beautiful. I really like it. It's luscious. It's pretty well balanced, but it still looks like hand-spun yarn. It's not something that looks like you bought it at a store. I mean, it definitely has a little bit of thick and thin, a little bit of inconsistency to it. It's wonderfully fluffy. Falkland refers to a region rather than a kind of sheep. And this, of course, I'm learning from my fleece and fiber source book. So Falkland wool comes from sheep of the Falkland Islands, and they can be a couple different breeds. But one thing that consumers like about Falkland wool is that the farmers there use really organic kinds of practices because they don't have a lot of pesticides and things available. So it's really nice, healthy wool that's coming from that location. Has a relatively long staple length, which makes it easy for beginning spinners to spin, but it isn't coarse. The yarn that I came up with is really nice and fluffy. I would use it for something to put around my neck or even something like a hat that's going to be against my forehead. It's not scratchy or itchy at all, and yet it feels very strong. It doesn't pull apart quite so easily as a merino would, for example. So I think it's a economical fiber to buy. It seems to take the dye especially well. There are a lot of subtleties in terms of the color. Sour Fig that Patricia dyes has greens and purples and lavenders, a little bit of brown. There's very little in the way of muddy color. So I came up with about 400 yards of a 2-ply fingering weight. A couple places it might be a little more like sport weight yarn, and no project as yet in mind to knit. So I'll be thinking about that, and always interested in suggestions you may have, especially if you're someone who spins and frequently knits with your hand spun. Like I said in an earlier episode, I think it's important not to sit around with a ton of hand spun in your stash. It's important to knit with it relatively soon, because as you get better and better as a spinner, that old hand spun starts to look less and less attractive. So I would like to knit with this Sour Fig Falkland while I think it's still fabulous yarn, and I'm looking for some project ideas if you have them. The front porch. I am now up to 5 purple hats for the Click for Babies project. And now I'm working on another new project. This is a pattern I received as a gift this very week from Andrea Delhi. Her Ravelry name is Orla Verstricht. She's from Germany, and she gave me the gift of Indian lentils, a pattern of her own design. It's a crochet pattern. It's available on Ravelry in German and in English. And I am crocheting this out of Noro Tayo sock with a G crochet hook. I think that's a little bit smaller than is recommended, possibly. This is such a timely gift, and I want to thank Andrea so much. First of all, it fits in perfectly with our lentils in the spotlight for the month of January. And second, I've been thinking that I need to get back into some crochet project. seeing Ashley Blaylock's work at Vogue Knitting Live this weekend and thinking about my roots, because the very beginning of my interest in the fiber arts was learning to crochet. And since I started the podcast, I haven't done very much work in crochet. So this is a simple pattern, but visually very interesting. And it's something that I can work on very easily when I'm watching something or talking with someone, because the pattern is easily memorized and the finishing touches are put on at the end. So I'm really looking forward to seeing how this comes out. Again, the pattern is Indian Lentils, available on Ravelry in German and in English, from Andrea Delhay. Thanks so much, Andrea. I really appreciate the gift of the pattern.
Acorns are dropping off my Jenny's house. Two ducks in my spyglass.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, you might want to like the Yarns at Yinhoo page on Facebook, join the Ravelry group, or leave a rating or a review on iTunes.
It's a mighty fine nature thing.
Music for this episode is Sweet. Music and lyrics by Samuel St. Thomas, performed by Krista Long and Cesar Diaz. Eat well and stay strong as you hone your post-apocalyptic skill set this week.
It's a sweet nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. Sycamore trees are blazing like a rainbow fire. Just like Linda Curtis, but I don't know why. It's a sweet nature thing. It's a sweet nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. Nature's ever get you high till your face is smile. Jump a river naked, hike a country mile. It's a sweet nature thing. It's a sweet nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a